and Bruff.
Wow.
You need an army.
On the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
There is one main question.
Why are you guys on the outside?
But also, how can the Canucks win the Stanley Cup?
Go off, young king.
What? Record levels almost of house positivity. What?
Go off.
Yeah.
What?
We've talked before about, like, and there's a playing legacy and there's the stuff you leave behind. But we're rookies at this job. I mean, there's no one can say that we come in and we should be doing a better job.
Here's Barzal revving it up over the Tampa line, middle of the ice. Little drop pass for Everly down the slot. Back in, he scores! Barzal to Ebbs! He fires the backhand home and the Islanders are on the board! They make it a 2-1 game!
You want to have as many voices as possible, and you're not going to agree on everything, but you have to get that input from different people and good people, and that's and from there you make the decisions.
Held in by Pelech, left point for Barzal, cutting to the high slot, finds Mayfield going to the net, shoot, he scores! Scotty Mayfield roasting!
I'm new in this role, but I truly believe that that's. It's about working together. It's from the top. It's from the owner down, and it ends up in the dressing room where they feel that we're all on the same page and we're doing this together.
Letty wrists it in around the wall in the Tampa end, far side to near. Lightning reverse it near side to far, but give it away. Bailey couldn't hold his own. Turnover in tight. Quick shot. They score.
Here are your hosts, Mike Alford and Jason Bruff.
Good morning, Vancouver. 6:02 on a Thursday. It is Alford. It is Bruff. It is Sportsnet 650. We are coming to you live from the Sportsnet 650 studios in beautiful Fairview Slopes in Vancouver. Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
Nephew Dom, how are you now?
Someone get Chris King a throw lodgement.
You know, we failed in not getting him to hit those high octaves during our show when he came on midweek.
Mm-hmm.
He was very, very demure, if I might say, because that was like watching someone go through puberty in real time. It was pretty impressive. That was a high pitch.
It was like they were pumping helium into the collie last night, not to mention the cigarettes and the beer cans being thrown on the ice. That was a fun Twitter moment last night when, wow, what a moment at the Coliseum, and yet all Twitter can do afterwards is fight about whether it was cool or not that Isles fans started throwing beers on the ice. Like,
just enjoy the moment, Twitter.
Yeah, just
try.
Can we have fun once? Just once. Let's have fun once without a massive controversy breaking out.
It was disgusting.
I was outraged.
Content warning. Beer. Got a couple bills to pay before we get into everything today. Alpine Credits, first and foremost. If you own your home, Alpine Credits can get your loan approved. Alpine Credits homeowners get approved. Visit alpinecredits.ca for more. Should also mention that Halford and Bruff in the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today. Visit your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. It's a big show.
We've got a really big show today.
Huge, huge, huge show. Halford and Bruff, Sportsnet 650. Jeff Merrick is going to kick things off at 6:30. So we will talk about that game last night. If the Isles don't go on to win this series, it's still a fitting farewell to the Collie. It was a nice way to end it at Nassau Coliseum because that was loud. It was emotional. It was exciting. And it was very Islander-esque at the end. The beer and Beauvillier saying it used to smell like cigarettes in here, but now it smells like beers.
It was also very Stanley Cup playoffs in that Nikita Kucherov was cross-checked big time. I don't know if that's what hurt Nikita Kucherov in the end.
But it may have led to the eventual injury.
Yeah, it may have contributed to it. I don't want to shock anyone, but there was no penalty called on the play.
It was Chris Lee again, wasn't it? The infamous Chris Lee taking a look at that one and saying, nope.
Do you remember almost, I think it might have been last year, that I said cross-checking is the new thing that the NHL is going to have to look at. Like, they've looked at the little slashes on the hands, and they've clamped down on that a little bit, at least during the regular season they did. Mm-hmm. Cross-checking is the new thing, where they have to figure something out. They have to figure out where the line is, because the players are taking advantage of referees who refuse to call any semblance of cross-checking unless... And not even. Even if it's the worst cross-check you can imagine in the playoffs, they're not calling anything. These aren't just shoves. This is textbook cross-checking, and nothing's getting called. They got to figure this out.
They did, however, call it in Game 2 of the Vegas-Colorado series, if you remember that. Going back a couple weeks, that's when you and I revisited this conversation for the first time recently. Saying we have no idea what constitutes a cross-check anymore. We had Justin Bourne on the show afterwards. Tried to pick his brain about when's the time to do it, when's the time to call it. But it's kind of become engulfed in this conversation about refereeing and how poor it's been consistency-wise in these playoffs. And it happened again last night.
If you're allowed to cross-check Nikita Kucherov, one of the superstars of the game, right in the ribs... Mm-hmm. And there's no call, then why wouldn't you do it all the time? I think it was Scott Mayfield who scored a pretty big goal last night, and he's a pretty rough and tough player. They're playing in the Coliseum. It was an intimidating, aggressive atmosphere. And I don't know. I don't want to kind of ruin this. It was such a fun time watching. Compared to the Vegas-Montreal game, which... With all due respect to Montreal Canadiens fans who probably thought that was pretty exciting, and Montreal did a great job of shutting down Vegas. It wasn't a very exciting game just because of what Montreal did to smother Vegas and frustrate them. Last night's game was like, it was just so much fun to watch. Even from my couch in Vancouver, I felt the excitement in the Coliseum. That being said, I don't love the fact that one of the best players in the series was taken out, and we don't know if he's going to be able to play Game 7 because of a blatant penalty and something that's been going on in the NHL for quite a while now. So we can talk to Jeff Merrick about that, and also Greg Wyshynski in the 7 o'clock hour. Mm-hmm. But the big guest on the Halford and Brough show this morning on Sportsnet 650, Canucks general manager Jim Benning, and we have all sorts of questions for Jim Benning, including, yes, we will ask Jim Benning in a joking sort of way, hey, can you let us know what John Weisbrod does? Can you let us know why you really like your right-hand man, John Weisbrod? What does he do? What is he good at? Tell us a little something about this mystery man.
What do you say you do around here? We could ask it like that. We could be like the Bobs. You and I could be the two Bobs. So again, 8 o'clock, Jim Benning. 7 o'clock, Greg Wyshynski, who was in the Coliseum last night, by the way. So we'll talk to him about that. 6:30, Jeff Merrick. As for what's coming up later today, you mentioned the Montreal Canadiens. They return home to Montreal with a chance to secure a spot in the Stanley Cup Finals for the first time in 28 years. Meanwhile, the Golden Knights will look to force a Game 7, which would be their second Game 7 of these playoffs, having previously gone to Game 7 in the first round against Minnesota. So that's what's on the tap. That's what's on tap for the NHL. The NBA tonight, the red-hot Phoenix Suns go to Los Angeles. The Sad Club Western Conference Championship now shifts to LA with the Suns holding a 2-0 lead. They'll look to put a further stranglehold on that tonight. So it's another awesome night of sports action. Sadly, no Euro today. And no Euro tomorrow either. It's 2 days off before the round of 16, which, by the way, is now set. That gets underway on Saturday morning. An unbelievable, unbelievable end to the group stage yesterday. I don't know how much you watched because I know you were golfing, but it was thrill-a-minute stuff for about an hour and a half.
We should talk about that in What Happened.
Hey, did you guys see the game last night?
No. What happened?
I missed all the action because I was...
We know how busy your life can be.
What happened?
Missed it?
You missed that?
What happened?
Big story, as mentioned, from Long Island. Anthony Beauvillier, Tito Beauvillier, they call him, scored at 108 of overtime. There's been a lot of quick overtimes in this playoffs. I don't know if you noticed that or not, but there's a lot that haven't gotten even past the five-minute mark
Do you think there was someone at the Coliseum or maybe a few people at the Coliseum that missed that goal?
Yes, absolutely. 78 seconds into overtime, for sure someone was in the concourse getting a beer, presumably to chuck on the ice in celebration. But yeah, definitely some people missed it. So Tito Beauvillier scores at 108 of overtime. The New York Islanders, the plucky New York Islanders, even the Stanley Cup semifinal with a 3-2 win over the Tampa Bay Lightning in Game 6. Let's hear what it sounded like again from our man Chris King.
Letty wrists it in around the wall in the Tampa end, far side to near. Lightning reverse it near side to far, but give it away. Bailey couldn't hold his own. Turnover in tight. Quick shot. They score! Anthony Beauvillier has won in overtime! Big goal! There will be a Game 7 Friday night in Tampa! Islanders win it 3-2!
I feel like we have to get Chris back on the show now. We almost owe it to the listeners. Beauvillier's goal comes after the Isles erase a 2-0 deficit. So that in and of itself really got the fans fired up. And then, of course, really quickly into overtime, they win it. Scott Mayfield with the big game. By the way, Braden Point scored again. Again. It's now 9 games in a row in the playoffs. He's one away from tying Reggie Leach's mark. Mm-hmm. The other big story, aside from the Isles coming back from an 8-0 drubbing and winning in that game, is the injury to Nikita Kucherov. So he exited early. It was after the cross check you mentioned. And then he tried to hit Matthew Barzal. Mm-hmm. Kind of missed. And he appeared to injure his arm. And then he left. And he never came back. And that was it. There's no update from John Cooper on what the injury might be.
I don't want to shock you, but John Cooper wasn't providing a ton of information about Nikita Kucherov. Imagine if he doesn't play Game 7, and then the Islanders win the series, the regrets that Tampa Bay will have, the fact that they had a 2-0 lead in Game 6, lose Kucherov, the Islanders storm back, win it in OT, and then he's not available for Game 7. And if that happens, and if it's determined that the cross-check by Scott Mayfield contributed to that injury, that's the type of thing that you know, gets the league going, look, that we can't have this happening.
It's interesting because in the aftermath of the Kucherov injury, the Lightning actually adjusted really well. They moved Anthony Cirelli up to a spot on the top line. They got out to the 2-0 lead and then started to make mistakes, tad uncharacteristic from a championship caliber team. It wasn't mentioned in the call or in our explanation, but the Beauvillier goal in overtime was a bad turnover from Blake Coleman.
Oh, it was awful.
It was a terrible turnover. They were sloppy with the puck, and it kind of allowed the door to be open just that little bit to allow the Islanders to get back into it and then, of course, win it in overtime. So that Game 7, which should be a beauty, it's going to be down in Tampa Bay. The Islanders have fought tooth and nail. They are a very endearing hockey team. Like, if you get them and Montreal in the final, it's going to be tough to choose. I hate putting it like this, but who pulls at the heartstrings more? Because the Islanders have this great story where they're playing in the last year in the Collie.
Who would you cheer for? I'd cheer for the Islanders.
I know you would. I know you would. I know you would.
Not even sad club. It's more that I don't want to see it. It's hard for me to say I don't want to see Montreal win because I've always said, you know, 1,000 times that if there's going to be a Canadian team to break the Stanley Cup drought, I only want it to be the Canucks. I have to admit, it's been hard for me to maintain that belief watching that team because there's a lot of players on that team that I really like. Like, how can you not like Brendan Gallagher?
You're a phony! Hey, this guy's a great big phony!
Or Carey Price, who might be a robot. There's a possibility that he's a robot.
It's true.
But then you look at the, I mean, even, this is weird to say, even Corey Perry has almost become endearing.
Yep, he's somewhat likable now. I don't know how it happened.
But he's like the old guy who's just trying to hang on to the career, and but he's at the same time, like he's finding something. And Cole Caulfield, this young guy that comes out of college and all of a sudden starts contributing. He's super talented.
Yeah.
Nick Suzuki is a nice player. Mm-hmm. Shea Weber, like they are a likable bunch there, and they're one of the true Cinderellas right now in Stanley Cup playoff history. And we don't have many Cinderellas anymore, because most teams that make the playoffs now, because half the teams make the playoffs, they're good teams. Like, they're not the, it's not like when the Canucks went to the Stanley Cup final in 1982 and you had teams that legitimately made the playoffs and they just weren't good because 16 of 21 teams made the playoffs. Now, the Canucks that made the playoffs that year weren't horrible, but they weren't great.
Speaking of the Canucks and speaking of good dudes and people to cheer for, do you want to talk about the Sedins? Daniel and Henrik Sedin were introduced yesterday as we roll on through what happened in a Zoom call along with General Manager Jim Benning, who, by the way, is going to be joining this program at 8 o'clock this morning. Be sure to stick around for that one. I'm hesitant to say interesting, because Zoom calls right about now are pretty perfunctory. People go up and they kind of utter the lines that they've practiced and they've rehashed in press releases. But there were some noteworthy takeaways from the Sedins' media availability. They touched on a couple of the issues that we discussed prior, including the notion that's floating out there that this was a PR hire. As a matter of fact, I think Henrik Sedin, if I'm not mistaken, actually uttered the line specifically talking about we're not a PR hire. And that happened on the Family Show right here on Sportsnet 650. Do you want to start with that clip?
That was the best stuff, I think, from the Family Show or the People Show. And Henrik Sedin, and I, you know, normally the Sedins aren't particularly outspoken guys, but I thought Henrik had some really good comments. So let's start with Henrik talking about the notion that's out there that this has nothing to do with trying to really improve the Canucks management group. This is all about the Canucks having a bad season and, trying to take advantage of the goodwill and the credibility that hiring the Sedins would provide.
That's the same as when we played. Like, people can say what they want, and there's nothing we can do about it. We have to come in and do the best we can. And I mean, we know why we stepped in, and that's all that matters. If people want to talk on the outside, that's a message, I think, to the players as well. And when you play in a Canadian market, there's going to be people are going to say what they think, and people are going to have input on your game. There's going to be stuff in the social media. There's going to be fans talking to you or media saying one thing. But you have to trust in what you're doing and how you think you perform. Now that's all that matters.
That's great advice right there, don't you think?
Ignore the haters, yo.
Something we should adhere
to a little more often, I think.
That. Please don't do that.
What's that?
Ignore the haters, yo.
Don't get in my... You're a hater right now, bro.
Yeah, you are a bit of a
you're,
hater.
You're hating on me.
I have that hater aid.
That's a good one.
I have a theory about the Sedins that behind the scenes, they might not be as nice and touchy-feely and accepting of everyone. Ned Flanders-esque as their public personas suggest. Now, I don't think they're dropping all sorts of F-bombs behind the scenes, and I don't think they're like running around having temper tantrums and screaming and yelling and swinging sticks in the dressing room and getting in the faces of guys. But I also think that these guys have very little time for players that aren't fully on board. And I want to play this other clip that we have from Henrik Sedin yesterday talking about how they felt when they were players about the importance that they themselves had to kind of set an example for the group.
That was always part of our culture too when we were here. We knew if we came into training camp not fully prepared. Like, what are the other guys gonna talk about when they walk away from that training camp? You're gonna be like, those guys are highest paid players and they're coming in like this, that's unacceptable. Why should we buy into the team system if they come in and they're not prepared? So we had Kevin Bechstad, Ryan Kessler, Yannick Hansen, Alex Heller. They came in and they wanted to beat us every training camp, and we made sure Kevin was third every training camp. So that's that was our biggest goal. But it's a little thing maybe, but in the end that it's a big thing. It ends up being a big thing, and that comes back to your training habits, your the way you play the game, the way you're around when you're in the dressing room. How do you come in every day? Like, do you come in sour because you lost the game, or do you come in upbeat and you want to be better? And that's it is small things, but it's to create the culture, it's a big thing.
I don't think these guys have much time for people that aren't on board. Mm. And I think about some of the Canucks that have come through in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've heard behind the scenes that they were frustrated with some of the players that they played with at the end of their careers. They would never come out and say it publicly, but they are competitive people.
Right. The question would be, how does that translate to anything tangible within the organization?
Yeah, great question. Yeah.
I started thinking about it. And one of the teams that's currently still playing hockey, the Tampa Bay Lightning, one of the big keys to their organizational success is that your roster spot is rarely guaranteed in Tampa Bay because they have so many guys in the American League just waiting to get a spot and never relinquish it. We talked to Brian Engblom about this a few years ago. It was right after the JT Miller trade, actually. Mm-hmm. Brian Engblom's the color analyst for the Tampa Bay Lightning. And he said, part of the program in the American League is finding guys that are going to gnaw at the bone and chomp away until they get their shot. And then when they get their shot, be it through ineffective play at the NHL level or an injury or whatever, they take that spot and they don't lose it. What that does is forces guys on the NHL roster to not take nights off and to not be casual. I feel like the Sedins could go a long way in implementing a similar program. Now, of course, you need the talent. Mm-hmm. You need talented young guys to come in and push, but Tampa Bay would do it with undrafted 20-year-olds from the Q that had 147 points in 60 games, and they'd all be there, and they all had hyphenated names, and you'd never heard of them before, and then they'd go, and they'd play 2 weeks with the big club, and John Cooper would be like, I can't send this guy down. He's too good. It happens all the time there, right? I mean, look at the squad right now. Guys burst their way onto that team. Yanni Gourde's a good example of that. And all of that is an organizational approach where if you work really hard and you dedicate yourself to your craft and you produce, you're going to get a shot. It might be a small opportunity, but you'll get one. And then what do you do with it afterwards?
Do you remember when he was talking about if you lose a game, you can't come in the next day and be sour about losing a game? You have to be upbeat. I have to admit, you know who I thought about? Petey.
Yeah.
I think the Sedins are going to be terrific for Pettersson, or at the very least, I want to see how it looks. Like, you know, you never know how it's going to work out when you bring in former players. Pettersson is going to have to be open mm-hmm. to hearing their advice. I think he will be, and not just because they're Swedish, just because, you know, they're good players and mm-hmm. they're future Hall of Famers. But do you remember last season? There were
yes.
Early in the season, Petey was pouting.
Yep,
he was pouting, and he was frustrated. And look, I get it. He was frustrated with his game, and we all want people that on the Canucks that want to play well, and they're not happy when they're not playing well. But what the Sedins are talking about is when you're a leader on the team, or when you're one of the best players and players are looking up to you because you're either a leader or you're one of the best players, you have to be upbeat as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And when everyone else, the thing I'm thinking about was, I think the Canucks scored a big goal or they won a big game and they panned the bench. Everyone is celebrating on the bench except Petey, mm-hmm. who's pouting about his game. That's a young guy who needs to learn that he has an impact on the team when he acts that way.
So a reminder, the Canucks conversation will continue in a major way at 8 o'clock as general manager Jim Benning joins us here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. I should also remind you that Greg Wyshynski is coming up at 7 and Jeff Merrick is coming up next at 6:30. I should also remind you that if you want to get great Vancouver golf for less, go to discountgolfcard.ca for all the details and to order your Vancouver discount golf card today. Coming up next, one half of the infamous Merrick versus Wyshynski podcast. Jeff Merrick joins us next on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. On a Thursday, Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. If you own your home, Alpine Credits can get your loan approved. Alpine Credits homeowners get approved. Visit alpinecredits.ca for more. We are also brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today. Visit your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. To the tie line we go. 31 thoughts. Sportsnet's NHL coverage. Jeff Merrick now on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
Does anybody really know what a tie line is?
Probably not. Probably not now that I think about it out loud. Actually,
I always wonder how industry geeky we should get with our conversations. I'm not hearing program feed. Does anybody understand what that means?
I
can't hear the show.
I should mention I also introduced Scotty Rintoul when he joins us. He is also on a tie line. So I'm using it a lot, but now I just realize.
I don't even know what it is. I just kind of nod. I'm like, it sounds good. Sounds better than a phone.
I've had this, this tie line box in my office since me and Wyshynski were doing the MVSW podcast, and I'll be damned if someone, said, okay, your career rests on you explaining what happens with the tie line box and why it sounds clear. I'd say, well, it's been a good run. I had a lot of fun.
Can you explain what's happening with the NHL officiating in these playoffs? I know you guys talked about it on 31 Thoughts.
Yeah, I don't know. It's I understand the calls are going to get missed. I think that's baked into the pie. I know there's a level of frustration that everybody has here, fans, coaches, players, managers, all of them. I'm not perfect, so I really don't like slamming and, berating officials over missed calls. But when it gets to a certain point, you kind of got to say something.
Mm-hmm.
It's been tough.
I'm
the last one that gets dragged. I get dragged kicking and screaming into the conversation about officiating. Like I'm always of the mind that I don't expect hockey players to be perfect, so I shouldn't expect officials to be perfect. Like I remember, I'll give you a quick example. It's like sort of detour of the story, but I will get back to Chris Lee because I know this is where we're heading. I remember playing beer league once and going at the referee about something. I can't remember what it was. And he turned to me and he said, "You want better officiating?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Be a better player. You're getting the level of officiating that you deserve." And I'm like, "Whoa, that's a really, really good point. I'm a really bad hockey player. Why do I expect this official to be better than I am?" Like, okay, you got me on that one. That's a good countermeasure. I don't expect officials to be perfect. Just like I don't expect hockey players to be perfect. But there have been some pretty egregious missed calls here. I understand that we want that players play with a certain intensity in the playoffs that they don't play with during the regular season. Friedman always goes out of his way to make this point. I do think it's the right one. We always assume that it's the officiating that changes in the postseason, where really it's the play that changes in the postseason. Like every shift is nasty. No one, licks the envelope and mails it in. Like everything is that much more intense. But this has not been a glorious playoffs, just by and large, like painting with a roller here. This has not been a great playoffs for the NHL officiating crew. And there does seem to be, a certain common denominator that we're seeing here as well.
It's funny because you said we're going to eventually get to Chris Lee. Like, I know he's had a really tough go and he's been front and center, but I don't really think that it's a Chris Lee problem.
Like, does he not know the cross-checking rule? Maybe he doesn't know the cross-checking rule.
There is that
no,
part
but
of
hang,
it.
Hang on. That's a really subtle... That's a really interesting point, too, because that is sort of a cross-checking... I mean, it's not like lacrosse, where it's like, yep, that's the sport, But cross-checking in the NHL has kind of existed in this weird spot where it happens all over the ice, all game long. And we kind of look at it and say, well, sometimes it's bad and sometimes it's not. Like sometimes a cross-check is, ooh, that's bad. And sometimes a cross-check is, well, that's just the game and let them play. And I get that it's a tough job to judge that at that single moment. But man, I think if nothing else, this offseason, the NHL needs to have a look at what do we want to do with cross checks,
because
and specifically cross checks around the boards. Like I'm one of these people that believes that we're at the beginning of the conversation about maybe ending hitting around the boards in general. Like board hitting, I think eventually is going to phase its way out of the game, and that's by penalty, not by how players play. But I think this is an off season where, you know, every year there's an audit on something. I wonder if this off season it's the audit on what do we do with cross-checking?
The thing is, and I agree with you, and we were talking about that earlier in the show, you know, they had a kind of a crackdown on slashes to the wrists, and I wonder if this cross-check on Kucherov, which is, you know, I know sometimes a cross-check is just, you know, especially if you're battling in front of the net, sometimes it's just part of the battle, but that was like a textbook cross-check. You know, if that's not a cross-check, then just take it out of the rule book, because, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. Where I was going with this, I can't quite remember, but
cross-checking,
I have that effect.
But I do wonder what it would look like, and, you know, where would you draw the line on cross-checking? Would it be like, you know, like,
I don't know.
Yeah, because that's what's happened. Eventually, the referees have basically said, nah, we're not going to call that cross-check in front of the net. That's just part of battling in hockey. And then it's gotten to the point where you're not going to call a cross-check on one of the team's best players, a superstar player, when it's an obvious cross-check. So you got to either... You got to look, I agree with you. You got to look at it entirely and set some sort of line in stone.
And I wonder if, you know, the one thing that you mentioned there, I mean, this is Nikita Kucherov, one of the best players in the game. You know, I mean, look at the, have a look at the points leader in the playoffs, regardless of how you felt about how Tampa handled his surgery and how he emerged and what he's done. Like, he's an elite player, one of the best in the game, period. I think one of the conversations that is, you know, already happening now, around the league is how do we keep the stars healthy and on the ice more? And whether that's and this has always been, you know, antithetical to how hockey thinks, but if it's more of a tighter enforcement of infractions against your Connor McDavids and your Nathan MacKinnons and your Elias Petterssons, etc., I don't think anybody will have a problem with that. Sorry, fourth line guy, you're going to get pounded and the referees are just going to say play on. But I mean, like any penalty other than puck over the glass, which is just the puck went over the glass and here's the automatic penalty. I mean, the reality that we deal with here is there are a number of different ways to interpret infractions. You know, what's a cross-check penalty to one person is a different cross-check penalty to someone. Like I would be willing to venture, like, amongst the three of us right now, we all have a different standard for things like what is goalie interference?
Sure.
What is a cross check? What is an appropriate slash when you knock the stick out of someone's hands? Like, at the end of it, I think as fans or as observers of the game, one thing we really do need to be a better job being settled with is this is a game that's still based on an interpretation of the rule book.
Yep.
It's always going to be there. Like, we all interpret penalties differently unless we have, you know, robot refs.
Yeah.
You know, like they're talking about robot umpires in baseball with balls and strikes. Until we have that, I don't think anybody's ultimately going to be happy.
I don't want to spend the entire segment with you just talking about penalties, because I'm kind of like you. Like, I hate the discussion and you got to drag me kicking and screaming into this discussion about officiating. And I think it shows that if you and I are at the point where, like, yeah, they probably have to look at something, then they probably have to look at it. But I do want to talk about the Coliseum last night. I know you're a student of the game. You know the history better than anyone I know. I threw this out on Twitter. Was that the biggest goal at the Coliseum since Bob Nystrom's goal when when the Islanders when he scored in overtime. Jim Robson on the call, by the way, for Hockey Night in Canada in 1980 against the Flyers. That
afternoon game.
Was it really? See, you do know the history.
I remember watching that at my friend Bob Makowitz's house, and it was an afternoon game. Yes.
So that was their first Stanley Cup. Now they obviously scored a bunch of big goals after that goal, because they won a few more Stanley Cups after that. But I was actually looking through some of their games and their history, and I'm just wondering if that goal last night stood up to pretty much anything except the Nystrom goal in Islanders history.
It felt like Islanders fans hope that they're going to win Game 7, clearly, mm-hmm. but if that was a goodbye, that's the way Islanders fans want to say goodbye to the Coliseum. Do you think that was part of it? Like, that was part of the emotion? Like, maybe this is the last time we're all together here.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And then that sort of element of emotion, that layer, you know, that layer of emotion gets added on to the Bevilier goal. I mean, ultimately, of course, it's not as big as something that happens in the Stanley Cup final. But I think as far as the legacy of the Coliseum, if that was the last playoff goal scored at the Coliseum, fans certainly recognized it. You know, I think everybody at that moment realized this may be the last time we see this in the playoffs. Let's treat it like it's a goodbye to the playoff Coliseum. So I'm not going to say it was certainly there with Nystrom in that goal against the Philadelphia Flyers for their first Stanley Cup. But, I mean, as far as a send-off for the Coliseum in the playoffs, as much as Islanders fans are hoping they win Game 7, I think in the back of everyone's mind who was celebrating yesterday and chucking water bottles and tins of beer on the ice, they're saying this is a fitting goodbye to this, you know, wonderful dump that we all loved and hated at the same time. Much like, you know, I've always maintained that part of the best thing about sports is hating sports at times. And I know that leagues don't understand that. And I think the first league that understands it is ultimately going to do themselves a great service. But as much as Islanders fans and anyone who went there may have hated the Coliseum, you also loved it because of the old charm about it and the atmosphere and the cups and, you know, the bow tie of Bill Torrey up in the raft. Like, all of it is wonderful. And I think that Bevilier goal and the reaction too was Islanders fans saying, thanks for some great memories here, everybody. We're Islanders fans. We might be moving on, but we're never going to forget the Coliseum.
Jeff, you're the best, buddy. Thanks a lot for doing this today. We really appreciate it. Enjoy the Habs and Golden Knights game tonight, and we'll talk again next week.
Ooh, we could have a Canadian. This is bizarro land, right? But we'll see what happens. Thanks, boys. We'll talk officiating in 7 more days. We'll find another controversy.
Can't wait. See you, Jeff.
See you, boys.
Jeff Merrick, 31 Thoughts, NHL coverage on Sportsnet here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
You know what I've noticed about the Islanders crowd? That's a young crowd.
Yes.
Have you noticed that as well?
Yes, they are.
Most of those fans, I would say, it's not a crowd that's like reliving the glory years there. Mm-hmm. That's a whole new... Most of those people weren't alive when the Islanders were winning Stanley Cups.
Right. I wonder how much has been passed down from the parents in the previous generation, the Islander fandom.
Maybe. Yeah. And I think that's just a real Long Island thing, too.
Well, that's also it, too. I don't think people maybe out here really understand the geography and the makeup of New York. Like, I'm sure they understand that Long Island is an island,
mm-hmm.
but it's almost its own separate entity. Like, it's part
own
of
its own culture.
It's,
almost.
It's part of New York. Yeah. But they don't consider themselves mm-hmm. anything to do with like Manhattan and the Upper West Side and the Upper East Side. You know what I mean? That's an entirely different New York. And the Coliseum is in a largely residential area.
Yeah.
Right. It's very difficult to get to the game. It's not constructed in a way where
it's suburban.
It's suburban. And and I think that that has made them endearing to that community for this generation, regardless of how successful they've been. Like, Islanders are, being an Islanders fan is something special to them because it's their team.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
they've put
all
up
of New
with
York's
so much
team.
Garbage too.
Yeah.
They have put up with crooked owners, horrible management, terrible teams, all this talk about we're getting a new arena. No, We're not getting a new arena. Okay, we're not getting a new arena, but we're moving to Brooklyn to a terrible arena for hockey, and it'll be a lot further for a lot of you guys to travel. Mm-hmm. No, that didn't work. All right, we're going back to the Coliseum, and they're finally getting a new arena next season that they're happy about.
Yeah.
And it's just for them, and they're heading into that. I've heard they're sold tickets for the new arena. So mm-hmm. the Islanders, this is a team that's, you know, with young stars like Matt Barzal as well. They've got Lou Lamoriello, 78-year-old general manager. I mean, it is, they're quite a story. And I have to admit, you know, when I was growing up, I hated the Islanders because they were so good and they beat the Canucks in 1982. So I always had that like, oh, you know, like I shouldn't like this team and these guys are bullies. Mm-hmm. They're the powerhouse. And now there's this lovable underdog that's come out of the ashes, and they're one win away from the Stanley Cup final.
So too are the Montreal.
I think I'm cheering for the Islanders.
So too are the Montreal Canadiens. They're one win away. That's coming up later today. Game 6, Centre Bell. I don't know how many fans are going to have in attendance. I'm assuming it's still at 3,500. I wonder if they'll try and squeeze a few more in. So we've got that later on in the day. Coming up on the show, 7 o'clock, Greg Wyshynski. 8 o'clock, Canucks general manager Jim Benning. It's a big show. It's the Halford and Brough Show. Don't go anywhere. Halford, Brough, Sportsnet, 650.
Musiala, first touch for the young substitute. Getting busy, looking to set up a teammate. Werner strikes it. Goretzka strikes it. And Leon Goretzka scores. Germany level for the second time. And real hope for them of staying in the tournament.
6:50 on a Thursday. Halford Graf, Sportsnet 650. That call you just heard from yesterday's scintillating afternoon of European Championship action. Hard lines for Dominik Shramaty, producer extraordinaire here. A Slovak-Hungarian. Did not go well on either front for you, Dom. You don't even want to talk about it, do you?
Oh, we can talk about it if you want.
You seemed upset in the moment.
Proud more than anything.
Proud.
Of the Hungarians, yeah.
Oh, right.
The Slovaks.
No,
the Slovaks.
I think they pooched it.
They did big time.
Yeah.
What a ridiculous own goal in that match as well.
Two of them.
Yeah. Not a good goaltending performance.
No.
I almost want to say that Spain got its tournament on track, but it's really hard to say that because two of the goals were just egregiously bad.
And Morata missed
the penalty. So I don't really know if they put their tournament back online. The drama that I'm talking about, of course, was in the final group, the group of death, where Hungary, who everybody assumed was going to be the sacrificial lamb of the group, was in it right until the bitter end. So Hungary, you'll remember, opened their campaign, played Portugal straight up for about 85 minutes before eventually kind of crumbling in the final five. Then got the draw against France, which was huge. Then got a draw yesterday against Germany, which, in a vacuum, was a terrific result. But they needed more, and they probably could have had more in the match because twice Germany had to rally back from a goal to even it up. Now, the casual soccer fan will look at the results yesterday and will say, what was so exciting about two games that ended in 2-2 draws? Like there were some goals scored, but they were ties. In that 90 minutes yesterday, England had almost every different opponent because as the scores were developing in real time, England was just waiting there to see who's going to finish second in the group because England won there. So at one point, it was France. At one point, it was Portugal. At one point, it was Hungary. And then finally, it was Germany.
You win, but beware. We Germans aren't all smiles and sunshine.
Ooh, the Germans. I'm so scared.
Yeah, you have to keep playing that because I almost feel like Mr. Burns right
Ooh,
now.
Ooh, the Germans are mad at me. I'm so scared. Ooh, the Germans.
Because I have to be honest with you, I got all these texts and tweets and, oh, now England's got Germany. Germany hasn't played well. Germany hasn't.
They were good again. They were very good, very very good against Portugal.
Okay, but
they were flat again. Flat is a good word against France, I would say. And
no, look, think back before that. They lost to North Macedonia in qualifying. They got pumped by Spain, I believe, in the Nations League. It was one of their worst losses in a while.
Yep.
They lost, I think, 6-0 to Spain. I was reading last night some analysis of the German team, and it was not being kind to them. Now, I know that England has not exactly been amazing at this tournament. They've won 2 games 1-0, and they drew Scotland 0-0. So they've only scored 2 goals in the tournament.
Yep.
But I would imagine that if this game is being played at Wembley, mm-hmm. I'm actually curious to know, does anyone know what the betting line? Who's the favorite here? I think it might be England.
England will be the favorite.
Yeah.
Although that's from a sportsbook perspective.
Right.
Yeah. I would say, like most of their matches right now, England's looking at this, and Southgate, to his credit, an immensely detailed individual. I always talk about that anecdote from the 2018 World Cup, where he, Southgate, of course, the shooter of one of the most famous penalty misses in England history,
mm-hmm.
spent countless amounts of time detailing how England would go about penalties, if it ever came to that. And of course, they got into a shootout with Colombia and eventually won, which was a huge thing.
They nearly lost.
Right, but they won. That was the big thing. And they were detailed down to, if I'm not mistaken, there was a rhythm and a routine, like shooter one will go in this direction and shooter two will, like, they had it very finitely detailed. Like, everyone knew what their job was when they stepped up. So it wasn't left to the nerve of a shooter. Anyway, I bring this up because Southgate has been, in anticipation of knowing the group, has been scouting opponents from the group of death for about 18 months.
Yeah.
And he's going to be very familiar with this German squad, which in this tournament has been prolific in terms of scoring goals over the last two matches. I don't want to call it
but they also nearly lost to Hungary. Yeah.
But they concede a lot. Well,
no offense, Tom.
Yeah, but they concede a lot. And it's very mm-hmm. uncharacteristic of a German squad that is usually very disciplined, very structured, and very adept at keeping the ball out of its own mesh. They have conceded a lot of goals.
It is going to be exciting, and I'm sure the tournament organizers are thrilled with the fact that England is going to play Germany at Wembley.
Well, and just so we don't make this exclusively about England, although Dom's, you're on the bandwagon now.
I got to support you too, so it's coming home. It's England 8-5 odds to win. They are slight favorites over Germany, who are 2-1 odds.
I do want to say, just because we are global here at the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. What other match are you most excited for? Is it Belgium and Portugal? Or is it the dark horse, Croatia, Spain?
Belgium and Portugal.
Belgium and Portugal.
Especially the way that Ronaldo, like, this is
Penaldo?
I mean,
seriously, though.
What?
So many penalties.
Too many penalties, especially in that match.
Mm-hmm.
Belgium, Portugal, take the over. Whatever the line is, take the over. That is going to be two teams.
I'll be cheering for Portugal on that one.
Two teams that know they're kind of flawed defensively and have kind of made up for it by just having so much attacking prowess.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that game could end 6-4, which would be amazing. And then, as we circle back to England, that half of the draw is so light on high-end elite teams compared to the other half.
Yeah. If England can get past Germany,
there's a road.
They'll be favored again in the next match.
By the way.
Yes.
Quickly, I know you want to break. France-Switzerland. France drew twice in the group.
They weren't overwhelmingly good.
I'm curious if Switzerland could pull out a result.
That's a tall ask.
I get that.
Yeah. It's a tall, tall order. But
I expected more.
Here's the thing, and you go back to the Southgate philosophy. If you can go in, like, everyone's hammering Southgate for the lack of creativity and originality that
mm-hmm.
England has brought to the pitch. They also haven't conceded a goal. That's part.
That's their MO.
That's it. It's low event football. And the hopes that you throw in a Grealish or a Saka or maybe Raheem Sterling gives you a moment of individual brilliance and they score.
Mm-hmm.
And then you shut it down from there. Is it entertaining to watch? No. I would much prefer to watch Belgium, Portugal. The best matches of the tournament have not been anywhere close.
That's why the England fans sing. There's nothing else to do.
Yeah, they're bored. Okay, 7 o'clock hour. Greg Wyshynski is coming up on the program. He was at the Coliseum last night for the Bolts and the Isles. We'll talk to him about how special that was and what might be the last ever game at Nassau. It's Halford and Brough, Sportsnet 650.